and played Snap Out at Winchester. One time we changed partners, driving home in the moonlight of middle June, and when I found Davis, and then I found Davis. We were married and lived together for 70 years, enjoying, working, raising the 12 children, 8 of whom we lost ere I had reached the age of 60. I spun, I wove, I kept house, I nursed the sick, I made the garden, and for holiday, rambled over the fields where sang the larks. And somewhere or other in this version, a line got obliterated, and I don't know what the next line is supposed to be. Maybe some of you already know, I don't know. But there's a line obliterated, and then it says, and by Spoon River gathering many a shell, and many a flower and medicinal reed, shouting to the wooded hills, singing to the green valleys. At 96, I had lived long enough, that in all, and passed to a sweet repose. And what is this that I hear of sorrow and weariness, anger, discontent, and drooping hopes? Degenerate sons and daughters, life is too strong for you. It takes life to love life. That was Lucinda Matlock. One of the gravestones that Edgar Lee Masters looked at Spoon River in Illinois. And the Spoon River anthology from which that comes is his telling the story of a lot of folks at Spoon River. Now, what in the world is that about? Well, my theme is faith and living a story, that there's some connection between those two. I don't know if about you, but I'm always conscious of living a story or in some aspect on a given day, various themes of my story are going to be expressed. I went on a hike yesterday. It was a vigorous hike. For part of the time I was by myself and flirting with a bit of danger and pushing myself as hard as I could. And that theme is part of my life for a long, long time. It's a major constituent of me and of how I got to be where I am, whatever that means. That there are times when one has to strain every muscle and keep on going past the first wind, second wind, third wind, and fourth wind. And that somehow or other, that's my way of being in the world. In my dealing with lots of people and attempt to minister to a few through my years, I've found an exciting ministry, or an excitement, I guess, of discovering what people's stories are. And that I see an important aspect of things that we can do for one another is in our impersonal time, when the fragments of our story are unknown to most of the people that we deal with, of helping each other discover each other's stories and affirm them and help them create maybe a better story that they're looking for. Harry Hansen has a story, provided me with an excellent illustration of how this works. Harry Hansen is a butcher at North Cape, Wisconsin. And if you stop by his meatpacking plant and say you're a minister, he'll probably give you a hunk of meat free. when I was his pastor, I found it very hard to pay for any of my own meat. He was always giving supplies to me. And beyond that, any clergyman within 20 miles or 30 miles who wandered in somehow or other got around to telling him who they were would walk out with some nourishment as well. Harry Hansen began as a dirt farmer, and from his Danish father learned the virtues of hard work and struggling with not the best sort of land in southern Wisconsin. During the Second World War, somehow or other, he got into the business of providing black market meat to the market of Milwaukee and so on, when there was such a thing called rationing. And that led him to, through the years, an awesome amount of hard work on his part, day after day, straining to the utmost, to a pretty good business. And now he was had 10 or so employees, and was able to provide very generously for his family and for his church. Everybody in the area respected him very much. I don't think he had any enemies. One Sunday afternoon, he had a party for his employees. Right in the meatpacking plant. Invited me, his pastor, over. It was a scrumptious celebration, and people were invited to tell some of their own stories along the way. It wasn't my idea, it was somebody else's, as I think back to it now. But I'll never forget how Harry Hansen summarized his own story. He said, and it is in reference to giving this part, the employees had expressed to him an immense amount of gratitude for his being the kindest employer, most generous, he was an inspiration of them and so on. It is time for him to make the last speech. And so Harry, unaccustomed to public speaking altogether, did manage to say some things. And he said, his last lines went something like this. I want to live in such a way that when the people come by my coffin and take a last look at me, they will want to say, "There lies a very foxy fellow." I'm not sure of all the meanings about what he meant by that, but it is clear that it was at the center of his day in and day out life. On the way out here, I visited my mother-in-law, who will be 90 in October. She still lives by herself, I think is very close to the edge of not being able to do that any longer, because a number of things are breaking down. Things seem to happen when you get around age 90 for most people. You have to nearly shout to communicate with her. She remembers some things and she forgets other things, and lots of them are kind of important. She doesn't know some people's names, even those who are related to her anymore. And her memory and her facilities come and go. And you sort of have to scramble around with an old person like her, but I think it's worth it. You have to kind of scramble around and work to get at the story that's going on yet, but the story is still there. We ended up talking at one place about her having been a school teacher 70 years ago in a small town in Minnesota. And how she had been invited back for a celebration at this small town, some anniversary of some sort. But she wasn't quite able to make it anymore for various reasons. But in the course of trying to arrange that, she did meet one of her students from 1908. She said that student of hers, that young lady, was very appreciative, was 80 year old, was very appreciative of what she had learned from her as a teacher, and that she still remembered something that she had been taught by my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law had a method of teaching probably common in those days, that if the children didn't have anything else to do, she would have things up on the board, like moralistic kinds of sayings, various truths about very practical kinds of things about how to live. One of the things was about a four-sentence bit of philosophy. And all of a sudden, out of the tarnished wreckage of my mother-in-law's memory, she was able to recite exactly, word for word, what that student had learned 70 years ago, and that she had taught, and what had been written on that board 70 years ago. And it is clear that that thing, that those lines were very close to the center of being the themes for her own story. And that's why it was so, it was still something that she could recite from heart, by heart. My mother died about 4 months ago. It is somewhat sudden. But we knew something was coming for the last year or so. This was 1,000 miles away from where I live now. But my younger brother was there. And it was clear from what he was able to report to us that in the last 2 or 3 days of her life, she was finishing up her story. In the combination of sadness and semi-happiness that my mother had in her life, she asked for very specific things to be done, how she was to be dressed in the coffin. She was supposed to have her glasses on, and even up to the last second of her life, the way she was able to say goodbye to my younger brother was as I know the story from all my years of knowing her, she was finishing out her particular story up to the very last second. Elizabeth Kübler-Ross, after interviewing 500 people on their deathbeds, one of the things that she's pretty well convinced of is that people, a very powerful drive in dying persons is to finish their story. She talks about unfinished business. And often people who have unfinished business, that is dealing with a broken relationship with a child, or seeing a son come home from war, or see a last daughter married, or something like that, it's when this last business gets done. And often the person will hang on unaccountably when all physiological signs indicate that this person ought to die, the person will hang on for a year or two or more until that business gets finished. And when the business gets finished, it's like turning off a switch. Boom, gone. Sometimes people who are really pretty healthy, but who finish their business, finish their story, die. Another aspect is Robert Butler, who's written some books on old age and on aging, thinks he has discovered something like an inevitable life review that occurs with people in their older years. It isn't something that people really set out to do because they have a certain sort of education and have been told that this is what you do, but rather he thinks he sees it happening in everyone, and that it isn't necessarily a good thing. Erickson agrees with the same thing when he says it's on the last stage. It's dealing with can you wrap up your life in terms of integrity, or does your story end up thrusting you into a sense of despair? And Butler indicates that some people who've been able to avoid the life review by various subterfuges and defenses all their life are not able to avoid it any longer in old age and grow psychotic because they can't handle the truths, the broken truths of their life review. A famous piece from literature is from Tolstoy, The Death of Ivan Ilyich, who when came time for life review, couldn't stand it and screamed, I forget how long, for a day or two. It seemed like an endless scream anyway. Anyway, that's a kind of one step in the introduction. I could put this piece in from Romans 8 a number of places in this morning session, but this is probably as good as any. Perhaps some of you went through this passage with Walter Bowman last day or two. It's from Romans 8, for all who are moved by the Spirit of God are sons of God. The Spirit you received is not a spirit of slavery, leading you back into a life of fear, but a spirit that makes us sons, enabling us to cry, Abba, Father. In that cry, the Spirit of God joins with our spirit in testifying that we are God's children, and of children, then heirs. We are God's heirs and Christ's fellow heirs, if we share his sufferings now in order to share his splendor hereafter. I could go on a long time with that passage, but just briefly, I see the Spirit as God's presence adopting us as his own, telling us, as it were, that the various broken pieces of our lives that we can only groan with are whole in the relationship, are made whole in the relationship offered to us with Jesus Christ, so that we are, our stories are healed in the fact that we can say Daddy to God and know that no matter where we go, how we go, where we've been, what the tensions are in our life, we have a place, we have a belonging, we have a story, we have a unity with God. And a destiny. We are heirs. We are going someplace with them. The story doesn't quit. It never quits. It goes on. That doesn't mean we're not, and it means also that the sufferings we go through have meaning because they are part of this destiny of being fellow heirs with Jesus Christ. Now that's one place where I make theological connection with this stuff about story, and faith. Some other things we could mention. God seems to according to scriptures, bother about our stories. Jesus says that God knows how many hairs are in our head. Or there's something else someplace about that God knows the fall of the sparrow. The particularities of our experience seem to be important to the divine, according to the biblical stuff. There's a place for unique stories in Christianity. Certainly, in relationship to others, but there's a place for the uniqueness. There is not just one story, one great ocean into which all the particularities of our life and experience are supposed to kind of flow. That's Eastern religion, where our individual stories don't matter. In fact, they get in the road of knowing God. In Christianity, the uniqueness of our stories is celebrated. And it's in that God, we know God uniquely in our lives in the world. Faithfulness to God is expressed in terms of the uniqueness of names. Names tell a story. Talk of a destiny. Talk of a type of servanthood. Talk of a set of meanings in the Bible. So Moses, the Old Testament is loaded with names of people where the story of the person's life is told in the name. Moses is one of them. Abraham, who gets his name changed as he has made the faithful one before God, is another. The story of Jacob is told in his name right from the second he's born, and the way he's born, and the his destiny, the story is just developed therefrom. The other famous ones are Simon Peter, who is named by Jesus as the Rock. That's Peter, who has a particular story to fulfill in the early church. We all know the story of Paul, who, when he's converted from one story to another, gets his name changed. And Jesus' name means that he is the one to save people from their sins. And that is told in his name from the beginning. In this sinful world, stories are broken. They need forgiveness. They need to be made whole by the story of Jesus. The image of Christ needs to come in and redo, transform the images by which we see our own stories and see the story of people around us and the story of all existence. We create our own story in the midst of our interpretation of the story that's being lived around us, that's happening around us. Our story is connected with the story of all creation, of all that's going on. Now, to go back to where I left things in this room on Monday, it occurs to me that we left it at just the right place. It's always interesting how one can redo one's stories. Like that, but we only got through the first two stages of Erickson, trust and autonomy, and I want to assert that trust, relationship, and then having the capacity to operate with some separateness in the midst of our relationships are the two basic movements of life, and that our stories tend to work with those two basic movements from that point on. The next stage of life for Erickson is the initiative stage, and there the child works with basic prototypes of what it is to be to live in the world. When a child is 3 or 4, he or she can't get enough of stories. You probably recall, some of you, of how hungry you were for stories when you were that age, and how your own children perhaps wanted to hear stories, and how TV in our day comes in and fills it in with those cartoon stories. And it's now when the child wants to be a farmer or a fireman or a policeman or a doctor or some dramatic personage in the world that will, I think, assert one's reality over against the very real possibility that the child is at this stage beginning to know that he may not be anything at all. Around age 4 or 5, the child discovers, is beginning in the process of discovering death, ultimate separation, ultimate disappearance. Human beings I think fill in the instinct gap with story. Animals know what their story is, it's built into them. Or a rock knows what its story is, it's built into it. Human being lives with this immense self-awareness, which includes death awareness, which includes the awareness that one can be nothing as well as something. There's lots of theological jargon that can be brought in at this point, the image of God. We live in the image of God. We are historical creatures. We are our history rather than our patterns of instinct. We are open beings. What the rest of the world takes for granted, its beginning, its movement, and its destiny, the human being has to decide, has to create. Obviously, our culture provides us with an immense amount of material to work with, lots of stories, lots of models for being something in the world. But each one of us, starting with this age of 4, somewhere in the just before school years and thereon, therefrom, each one of us has to discover, put together the unique pieces of our own experience, and put it into some sort of order. Eric Byrne says that at this time in life, with this transactional analysis theory, says that at this stage of life, the child learns to live a script. And that one of the reasons why children are so hungry for these stories is that they're looking for one that can be the pattern for their life. And he does some, in his book, What Do You Say After You Say Hello, lines out a number of scripts that flow out of fairy tales. Bruno Bettelheim has also recently written a book on the use of fairy tales to help put together the fragments of our life. What do you say after you say hello? Eric Byrne says, well, you don't know exactly what you're going in between what you say hello and you say goodbye, you have to figure out, now what do we do with each other? And our stories help shape our interaction, help us fill in the time. As we live in time, we live stories in time. And Eric Byrne writes some fascinating things about how, a little girl may decide that she really likes Little Red Riding Hood. She likes Little Red Riding Hood because it makes sense at a gut level of the conflicts in her own life and living with her family. Finds her unity, her selfhood, her oneness. I don't know exactly what word to use exactly, but she finds a theme for making sense of her experience thereafter from being Little Red Riding Hood. And Byrne says, we go through life populating our lives with people who are now going to fulfill the themes that we've decided we want to live as we live out our story. This sounds a little ridiculous, but sometimes you look at some tragedies in human life and decide it's as good a theory as any, because it wouldn't be Little Red Riding Hood, but Little Red Riding Hood will always look for a wolf of some sort, or so on. I don't know what theme, what title you'd give to it, it's very interesting how research tells us that women who have lived in a home where the father beat the mother and maybe them, go out and marry a man who does the same thing to them. And they may end up divorcing that person and going out and marrying another one who does the same thing. Or the same thing can obtain in relationship to alcoholics. So something like this script business must be there. Byrne says that this script always includes whether you're going to be a winner or a loser, and you're sort of deciding in your story whether that's the part you want to play, the one on top or the one who gets beaten. Or he also indicates that there are things like victims, persecutors, and rescuers, this kind of perpetual triangle that happened in our experience as well. Erickson, in his next stage, industry versus inferiority stage, a school age time, is saying some of the same sort of things that the child learns to build into his story, whether he is somebody who is competent, can manage to be a successful participant or potential successful participant in the economic and technical flow of life, or whether he's going to be one who can't quite make it, whether in school or wherever. And anybody who's been a teacher knows that once a child has concluded that he can't do it, that theme is the one that's got to finally get kicked out of the child somehow or other, or worked out of him before he can actually do anything in school. And in general, our school system hasn't fully, it seems to me, taken hold of the fact that the child learns a particular theme about its life, about success or about failure. Just continuing on with Erickson's stuff in very quick fashion, in the identity stage, we put together all the pieces of all the images of the way we could be, all the partial stories of our life that have sort of been laid on us by our experience with parents significant others of various sorts, education, physical attributes, and so on. But we put together these pieces into a kind of focused identity which is going to stay with us pretty much the rest of our lives. In the next stage of intimacy versus isolation, we put this identity together with another person, and we learn the art of sharing an identity. Then out of that sharing of an identity, that closeness, we usually produce some sort of outcome, some sort of offspring, some sort of product, child or whatever, that we now take on the identity of nurturing into its story, and hopefully it's going to be a follow-up, some sort of continuation of the story that we have developed in living in the world. And finally, the last stage, integrity, wraps it all up, and we have to take a look in our life review about whether we've managed to live one story or not, and face the fact about how much lying we had to do to make one story out of the mix-ups of our experience. Another way of putting it is something that just struck me this morning, that in our story, is one of becoming more and more real. Taking the dreamlike stuff that we sort of look out at the world with when we're a child, about being a good girl or a good boy or a member of the Cabots or a member of the Smith family or whatever, or being a Christian, if you will. And that then we this story of our life is sort of worked in and through all the things that happen to us and that we try to do in life. And the rough edges get worn down, and sometimes it looks as if our stories has really taken some unexpected turns, and we don't know whether we can really own all the pieces of our story or not. But with a bit of grace, we do manage to live a story. And Gail Shee, in her book Passages, quotes something that probably many of you have heard before. It's from The Velveteen Rabbit. And it's talking about what becoming real is. One day the young rabbit asks the skin horse, who has been around the nursery quite some time, what is real and does it hurt? Sometimes, says the skin horse, for he is always truthful. When you're real, you don't mind being hurt. Does it happen all at once, like being wound up, he asked, or bit by bit? This business about becoming real. It doesn't happen all at once, said the skin horse. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily or have sharp edges or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off and your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby, but these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand. Have you had the experience of meeting somebody for the first time and thinking they're kind of ugly, physically? And then you get to know the person, and you get to know their story, and you know how real they are, and you think they look pretty darn good. That's how this stuff about living a story and becoming a story and sharing a story works, I think, individually and with one another. Somebody sent me a cartoon. This is sort of an aside in some ways. Again, but it does illustrate the next point, that there's a kind of progress, a process of development, one chapter of another, one thing building upon another. There's a change of themes, a major themes in our story. It's a cartoon where there are two obviously well-to-do businessmen or something or other, scholars or something, sitting there having an after work drink or something. And one person is saying to the other, first it's sex, then money, then you weed out, simplify, and you find power is enough. Anyway, I think there is a putting together of the ups and downs of our life into a plot, into a storyline. Whenever somebody does a biography or an autobiography, it works only because people are able to find a storyline. They're able to put together the pieces of this complex human being, usually, into a theme, and they usually put it into the title. The storyline makes a unity out of all the pieces of this person's life, ties it together so that what happened early in the person's life fits together with what happens later. And there's another part of it, into and under both of these, that there's a sense that this person lived this life, was in charge of it at its crucial places, rather than have it that life happened to this person. St. Paul does some of this in one of his letters to Timothy, I believe, where he says, he puts a theme on his life. I have fought the good fight, I have kept the faith. I have in my grand design for this hour right now a little talking with each other here. So if you don't mind, I don't know if we have time. We only have 10 minutes. Rather than talk with each other, let's throw it out to the whole group. It's probably a small enough group to do something like this. But as a way of preparing for discussion in the whole group, think about your own life or a life of somebody that you've known well. Put together, sort of make a list of main themes in that person's life, or main images of the way that person is or was, or metaphors, a few of them that sort of put together, kind of add up to the main qualities that this person seemed to have. You might throw in some other things. Was there sort of a built-in readiness to win or to lose in this person's life? Think of some, just put together a set of these things. Images, themes, metaphors. And then sort of look at that life as a whole. Add up those themes. And if you were going to write a book about yourself or about this other person, what title would you give it?
I just wanted to ask, is what you're thinking on the possibility of some sort of model other than winner or loser. And Jolene talks about our model of relationships as being Hebrew and Pharaoh.
And being what?
Hebrew and Pharaoh. Somebody's a slave and somebody's master. Or loser and winner. He says, he's an anthropologist, and he says that just isn't always so with other cultures. What you're thinking about us breaking out of that kind of either or.
Yeah, I'm at this point making a case for winner or loser being the way of dividing up humanity at this point. I'm open to any set of themes like this. It may well be that anthropology can show us the variety of compelling themes that human beings seem to live. So whatever you might suggest as other themes. But the point I'm making is I think people, in living out their story, get hooked into a theme. Even if it's a loser theme, it's a powerful thing because it gives unity and continuity to my experience when changing the themes would make the person unrecognizable to himself or to herself. Some of the business about oppression and the oppressed and the oppressor, whether we're speaking about the oppression of women in some cultures, probably ours, or of the black man being oppressed by the white man in various places, that the people like Paulo Freire in The Education of the Oppressed points out that a major thing that's got to get done in the freeing of people is help them work out of their negative identity that gives them some kind of consistency. So the dependent person or the oppressed person or the refugee person holds on to this negative identity as it were, even when he or she doesn't need to do it, hold on to that anymore objectively, but because it's a consistent theme in his life.
You can really see that with the Vietnamese refugees, because I teach them all, and some of them come in the country, but I'm going to make it, you know, make. And others come in that I, you know, no matter how hard I try, I'll never learn.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't, they can't learn, and yet, but, you know, if they try hard enough, then they get that attitude change, and they're okay. I see that.
Yeah.
Well, this is really a bothersome question to me.
Is what?
It's a bothersome issue when we begin to use the metaphor of story to describe our life. Because that's precisely the example you mentioned. It is what is reinforced. And that is the sense of feeling perhaps compelled to a kind of consistency. We don't want to ruin the story after all. And so the sense of radical departure is less open to us. In fact, this seems to me the devastating criticism of Chahi's book Passages, and that is that she describes these stages as kind of hurdles over which all of us must kind of struggle, and life mounts to kind of preparing for and executing these little hurdles in the stages of our lives. What a bleak assessment of the human enterprise. It seems to me that is. And to emphasize the importance of story, having a plot, you need to turn it often too much backwards, rather than to free us to the If we describe ourselves as a winner,
mm-hmm.
and if I do at age 35 describe myself as a winner, then I want to live out this story, and so I will continue to win and perhaps then continue to oppress others with that particular
mm-hmm.
plot outline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to be open to turning myself into something other than a loser, and when I describe my life as a story, I'm really not so able to do that.
It's not so much what makes us happy, it's kind of the way it is. It's in my capacity to choose to look at not what makes people happy, but the way life is for most people. Okay. Unless you can break out of that passage and make your own story. Okay.
Do you live with leaders and followers? But that's, you kind of get yourself pegged as a...
Mm-hmm.
A server,
mm-hmm.
one
mm-hmm.
who enjoys being served.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's tragedy. I mean, this story business points out that once you get locked into a certain story, it's tough to break away from that, and it hurts yourself and others.
Be both. I mean. Are you saying that if you've got yourself pegged as a loser, or you've got yourself pegged as one who serves rather than one who is able to be served, you mean you can jump back and forth on those? Is it possible, or do you have to take one path?
I don't know. I can't quite get my head around your question right now.
I would enjoy responding to that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I was just thinking of my own story while you were talking. And I think my story is a very mixed bag because I had a very aggressive older sister. And yet I was second in line, and I started bossing around as she did to me, my younger brothers and sisters. And I was just thinking that my story has got to have come from the incident when I was doing this, and I saw the pain on my younger sister's face, and I remembered my own pain. And then I made kind of a turnabout at that point. I thought, I am never again going to ask someone to do something I don't want to do, you know. I'm not going to do that to somebody else. But then I have a mixed bag of my life as I've caught myself doing this again and again, you know, and then being determined that I am going to be the servant and not the, you know, the oppressor, and this whole struggle of doing this all my life, because coming as one of the older ones in the family, of course I always have the younger ones, and that shaped my story. I think it's very good for me to think of it as a story. I've never done that before, and maybe to even know where I'm coming from would be very good. And I've been told by, oh, you think of yourself like that? I've never thought of you as like, you know, in that way, and discovered all of a sudden that the story that I have about myself is not even reality, you know? And it would be very good to discuss with other people your own story and maybe get some truth by the way they see you. I mean, it would really be fun to do that.
Now, essentially, what you do in psychotherapy is rehearse your story and look at it. Maybe discover some places you really want to work hard at changing it. Religious conversion, it seems to me, usually takes a story going down the wrong track and puts it in a different context and says, you don't have to stay on this track, you can, there's a turnoff here called Jesus. That doesn't mean that you stop being the person that you have been. It says we use that which has been given you in your life, sometimes even the worst kind of stuff, and make something better of it. You know, the Alcoholics Anonymous is in the business of taking a rotten story and not taking the person and flipping him to a heaven where he forgets he never was an alcoholic, which in Alcoholics Anonymous, you rehearse the fact that you have been and always will be an alcoholic, but now you're putting your alcoholism to a positive use in serving others. sounds to me, as you, in a little bit that you talked about here, that that the victim, persecutor, and rescuer themes could be useful in your dealing with some of your stuff in your family.
Well, a leader doesn't necessarily have to be a oppressor, though. A leader could just as well be a servant, in a sense.
Yeah, what often happens is that really or potentially oppressive themes, like being on top of the heap, can be turned into a benevolent kind of thing. So there are Rockefellers who continue the theme of being in the upper crust of society, and that's basic to being a Rockefeller. That's their story. They can't avoid it. Some of them would like to avoid it, but they can't. They then turn it into, like the Rockefeller who was just killed in an auto accident a few weeks ago. That he spent nearly all of his life doing good works. He kept that one aspect of the Rockefeller story, but changed the character of the leadership as it were. I guess, sort of picking up some of the things that Phil is pointing out, I guess one of the things he's picking up is that this story stuff tends to be very, he keeps one hooked into the past, makes it difficult to change. I admit that that's the way it is. I observe people and I see that things that happen to them in their life never go away. That's always there. But I see the possibility of transformation, of building on that. You can never be sure which direction the building is going to go. You're not trapped to living the same repeating and rigid repetition compulsion that Freud saw as he looked at this story business. From 5 years on to 85, but the future is always going to be in continuity with the past. It's always going to be somehow or other. When you look at all the twists and turns, somehow or other, you can make sense. You can make autobiographical story sense of a human life, and of the life of a community. The first places I really put this approach to doing theology to work was in my study of Søren Kierkegaard, who is, in his own autobiography, looked at himself as a spy, as somebody who didn't quite belong in the world, but was able to spy things out. And when he finally puts all the twists and turns and pains of his life together, he said that his identity was, his story was that he was a spy in a higher service. And it's interesting, one of the things that I then did was to look at how Kierkegaard looked out at the world and experience in general with that lens, with the lens of his own story, developing story, and you can see how he looks at God as a spy, Christ as a spy, church as a spy. He's come up with a lens whereby he looks at a lot of experience. And I submit that each one of us tends to look out at the world in terms of the particular lens, the particular story that we've developed, and makes friends, decides who's friends and who's enemies on the basis of the story that I've made up, so to speak, about myself and the nature of the world. So, another point that I make about this is that what the story I make up about myself, about my way of life, always ties in with the way life is, with my ideology. My identity and my ideology go together.
It seems to me that if you know your story, that
there you have a handle on being able to do something about it. If you don't know what's going on, then you kind of hit and miss.
Yeah, well, again, it's a description of the way life is, but I think it also describes the tragedy of life as well as the greatness of it. The Nazis lived a story, and they had to have a certain set of enemies that fit exactly their story, the Jews. And it is only in living out that story then, is from living out that story that they did all the damage that they did. And I think that I continue to see this pattern of using the story of what the way life is to push away, to hurt that which is inimical to my story. Yeah.
There again, is that the mother and father established that pattern for you of win or lose, or you know, or story.
They help, and I'm aware that there are lots of pieces in my life that flow out of my father's life and out of my father's father's life and so on. I think this is true of most people, but I'm not ready to blame all of my story on my parents, because I took hold of my story and I've made for good and for ill a unique mess out of it. I'm gonna stop here.